Philip Larkin was adored by his friends. "Funniest man I've ever known," said his editor, Charles Monteith. "The best company of anyone I've met," Anthony Thwaite once told me. Yet this private Larkin, playful, puckish, self-deprecating, a terrific mimic and a natural entertainer, was distinctly and deliberately at odds with Larkin's carefully developed public persona. In his writing and public utterance, Larkin often defined himself in terms of his dislikes. He was rude about most of his fellow poets, had a virtual phobia about foreign travel, hated the democratizing and lowering effects of modern politics, seemed to despise the new immigrants to British culture, and cringed at the thought of the mass of humans going about their lives. He lived in a permanent state of fastidious recoil. Even his private and jokey persona with his friends was based on ironizing and dramatizing his dislikes. He was never funnier than when he was loathing something. But though the range of Larkin's disapproval was panoptic, there was only one thing that he both detested and feared, and that was death. Not death generally. He could contemplate the large-scale extinction of his fellow man with an equanimity approaching satisfaction. No, what he could not abide was the contemplation of his own death. And this terror, it was nothing less, didn't abate as one might have hoped as time went on and the inevitable approached. One of his most successful poems, O Bard, is quite frank about this.
I work all day and get half drunk at night. Waking at 4 to soundless dark, I stare. In time the curtain edges will grow light. Till then I see what's really always there. Unresting death. A whole day nearer now. Making all thought impossible, but how and where and when I myself shall die. Arid interrogation, yet the dread of dying and being dead flashes afresh to hold and horrify.
During the course of his final illness in 1985, the prospect of imminent death paralyzed him. He could neither face the truth nor keep it out of his mind for a moment. It was time to put his house in order, but he lacked the will to do so. His health declined, he lost appetite and weight, and though he continued to visit the doctor, he had fading hopes of recovery. 3 days before his death, Philip Larkin asked his lover Monica Jones to destroy my diaries. And because she was housebound at the time, Monica asked Larkin's secretary, Betty McAreth, to do the job. First, taking off the covers of the books in order to preserve them, she fed the 30 volumes into a shredder and then, for good measure, incinerated the strips of shredded paper. Within hours, the documents that one imagines most explicitly revealed the inner life of one of the 20th century's greatest poets were no more. I sometimes wonder why Larkin didn't do it himself. Perhaps it would have felt like a form of suicide. Philip Roth is rather good on this subject. He says, it takes more courage than one might imagine to destroy secret diaries, to obliterate forever the relic-like force of those things that, almost alone of our possessions, decisively answer the question, can it really be that I am like this? Larkin died early on Monday morning of December 2nd, remarking faintly to the nurse who was holding his hand at the bedside, I am going to the inevitable, which has a vaguely Larkinish ring to it, as if he were going to the Trocadero. But as last words go, it hardly compares with Spike Milligan's wonderful and immortal, see, I told you I was ill. Presumably Larkin's trip to the inevitable was eased when it was confirmed to him that his diaries were no more. And it's hard to question the wisdom of obeying a dying man's virtual last request. Yet many commentators have wondered whether it was right to accede to Larkin's wish. To get this into perspective, let's remember the analogous and much more consequential case of Franz Kafka, who left an instruction to destroy all of his unpublished manuscripts to his friend and literary executor Max Brod, and which Brod chose to ignore. As a result of this, we have the novels the trial, the castle, and America. But the difference between the cases are important. Kafka asked for the destruction to be done after his death, so he could never confirm that his wishes had been carried out. And it was clear even at that moment that works of the highest importance to Western literature were at risk. There's a nice, almost a classical, conflict of duties here. Should Brod keep his word and honor his friend's wishes, or break his word and honor his friend's genius? The key, therefore, surely, lies in the importance of what would be lost. So when we return to the case of Larkin, we have to ask, how important were these diaries in themselves and to our understanding of Larkin as man and artist? Were they so significant that an intimate friend would have felt justified in lying to him about having destroyed them? But of course, we don't know exactly what was in them, so it's hard to judge how important they might have been. Various friends of Larkin's have speculated about their contents. Jean Hartley, who with her husband George published Larkin's seminal collection, The Less Deceived, believed that they revealed Larkin at his bitchiest and most coruscating about those closest to him. Robert Conquest, on the other hand, a very old friend of Larkin's and his partner in various stealthy visits round the porn shops of Soho in the 1950s, once told me that the diaries consisted largely of sexual fantasies and that Western literature would have suffered no loss if they were shredded. So what was the truth? I asked Anthony Thwaite, one of Larkin's literary trustees and the editor of his Poems and Letters, whether he regarded the loss of the diaries as regrettable and what he thought their contents might have been.
The one person that one is aware of who did actually look at some of the diaries, she wasn't meant to, and Larkin was pretty cross with her, was Patsy, with whom Larkin had an affair in the 1950s in Belfast. And she said that they were a mixture of grumbles and complaints about his neighbours and colleagues and friends and sort of erotic fantasies of one sort and another. Not surprising. The other person who did glance at the stuff was Betty Macareth, who was for very many years Larkin's secretary at the library in the Brynmore Jones Library in Hull. And she is the person who was given the task of taking the diaries to the shredding machine in the university library. And Betty has said that she couldn't help seeing some of the stuff as it was fed in by her, and it was the sort of stuff you wouldn't want anybody else to see. I think that Monica was right to obey Larkin's instructions. He made it very plain, apparently, several times to her. She told me this, she told Andrew Motion this. Several times he said, make sure those diaries are destroyed. He didn't talk about destruction or anything else but the diaries. He wanted them out of the way. She obeyed him. She did the right thing. Yes, she did the right thing.
I am a rare book and manuscript dealer, and I've sold the archives of many writers. There are very often diaries, journals, personal letters included in such sales, and they often involve some degree of intimate disclosure. It's not uncommon in some cases, when the friends and relatives are still alive, for the writer or his estate to stipulate that certain material cannot be made available to the public for a period of time, often 75 years. Might this not have been done with Larkin's diaries? The problem is that such decisions are usually made at the wrong time, often in the immediate aftermath of a death. Soon after Sylvia Plath died, Ted Hughes destroyed one of her journals, thinking that its contents would have been too raw, too distressing for her children, even when they were grown up. Surely, though, as a generation of Plath scholars have sometimes stridently claimed, he was wrong. That journal could have been put under embargo for a period of time. And I'll bet that if Ted Hughes had thought of this, he might well have done so. And it could have happened with the Larkin diaries, too. In 100 years, who would care if they were rude about a lot of largely forgotten people, or were more or less sexually revealing? Assuming that Larkin's reputation will survive, and it just might, surely our successors would learn more about him and more about us from their continued existence. But he didn't want us to. In writing in a diary, we partake of a secular version of the confessional, in which the writer is both penitent and priest, and absolution is delivered in the very act of honest self-revelation. It's a private activity. Dear diary, we say, implicitly mirroring dear God. In the uncensored exposure of what Philip Roth calls what I am like, at the Larkinian extremes of the splenetic or the libidinal, one is at one's worst, and paradoxically at one's best, clear-eyed, undefended, humble. The diaries were private. According to Anthony Thwaite, only one person ever sneaked a look at them, and Larkin was understandably furious with her. He would have been even more outraged and humiliated, if one can imagine being so post-mortem, by the public exposure of his inward musings. In destroying his diaries, he was adjusting the image of himself that would prevail. His well-loved poem, An Arundel Tomb, concludes with an often cited and frequently misunderstood line, "What will survive of us is love." The previous line, however, makes it clear that there are conditions attached to this sentiment, which is an almost instinct, almost true. That is, it is what we strive for and wish and fail to achieve. But surely it's better for a little love to survive, however mitigated, than a lot of bitchiness and sexual fantasy. Mere curiosity is not a strong or worthy enough motive for the preservation of such diaries, as Anthony Thwaite has wryly observed.
Whether I would like to read them myself, I don't think so. I mean, there is a sort of horrible curiosity in me that would say, yes, I would like to read them. But when I think now, and when I think thought many times since edition of the Selected Letters of Larkin, the sanctimonious stuff that poured out in screeds then about this dreadful man, I don't think I would want to be responsible for any further heaping of coals and ashes on the reputation of Philip Larkin. I mean, I think the letters were well worth publishing, they're highly entertaining, and that what so many people have missed is that they are tremendous performances. I dare say that the diaries were not performances. They were written just for an audience of one, himself, and that was that. And so, you know, one can see why he didn't want anybody else to see them and why he told Monica to make sure that they were destroyed.
I hate the destruction of the historical record. We live and understand and accumulate a sense of ourselves as a culture through the preservation of the pieces of paper that record what we truly are and have been. But I find it hard to regret the destruction of Philip Larkin's diaries. Our final view of him is probably more sympathetic, indeed more loving, as a consequence of their ultimate cremation.